You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome again to another edition of the Red Reporter Podcast. I'm your host, PK. And alongside me this week, we have Wick Terrell. Wick, how are you?
I'm good, guys. Glad to have another episode rolling.
Yeah, yeah. Season's just about here, so.
Last one before the season starts, I guess, right?
Probably. Yeah. Probably. We might sneak in another one here.
Right before opening day? But
yeah, possibly. Possibly. Still some moving parts there, but and then also we have Eric Roseberry. Eric, how are you?
I'm good. You know, I spent part of the day editing a chapter on the Diamondbacks farm system for something coming out, and I feel a lot better about where Cincinnati's at, so I am feeling good tonight.
Yeah.
The post-Kevin Towers, Dave Stewart farm system? Yeah.
It's not great.
Not awesome.
But didn't they just have the number one pick?
Got some bad news, Trey.
Dansby Swanson's great. Yeah.
Good horse.
About that. And without further ado, you just heard him, our special guest this week from the Cincinnati Enquirer, see Trent Rosecrans. Trent, how are you?
Well, good. I would go with guest. I don't know how special I am unless it's kind of a backhanded compliment. But, yeah, no, guest. Guest.
So, reporting live from Goodyear. So we're just going to kind of get his thoughts on the team so far. And with, you know, we are officially, as we record, we are 1 week away from the season starting. So still plenty of moving parts, though. It's not like years past where the season, the roster has been set in stone since day one of spring training. There's still plenty of movement left. So let's just go into, I guess, the news of the day, and probably the biggest news of the week, is that the Reds ended up releasing Ryan Rayburn. He was one of the guys that we were talking about potentially getting a bench spot here. Let's just kind of go into what that means kind of for him and what that means for, you know, how the Reds are going to approach their bench situation here leading into the season.
Yeah, I was actually kind of surprised. I thought Rayburn kind of secured a spot on the team. Mm-hmm. But what it shows is that they'll probably go with a four-man bench and an eight-man bullpen. And that means they need a lot of flexibility from those, well, basically three bench players, because one is a backup catcher.
Right.
And so it could mean that they're going to really try to keep Stuart Turner around. And so start the season with eight, then do seven in the bullpen, but still have a third catcher, which would be kind of tough to do. But, you know, Turner's kind of impressed. The thing with Turner is everybody knew his glove, and his bat has looked pretty good here. So maybe that's something into it. I wasn't around today, so I haven't really talked to anybody. I was, like, we talked before we went on air. I was driving back from Las Vegas, where I watched the two exhibition games out there. So I think what it just shows is that they need flexibility on the bench, that they're going to probably go short, whether that means an eight-man bullpen or a seven-man bullpen and a third catcher. So
you have to have guys like.
Like, I thought Rayburn and Arismendi Alcantara were on the team. I was wrong about one, but I think this reinforces that the other one is a lock.
Right. Right.
Yeah, for me, the initial reaction I had was that, you know, when you look up the way the season starts and there's always those built-in off days because of April weather and from just kind of getting the season up and rolling, oftentimes you'll see teams kind of go with the exact opposite of what the Reds are doing, where they've got a shortened bullpen and only maybe four starters they're currently carrying and the extra bench bat because they can, you know, they can rest guys on those off days. And so the fact that the Reds are doing the eight-man bullpen experience and the short bench at any point in time is kind of telling. But the fact they're doing it to start the season when they've got all those other things that suggest that maybe they could have done the exact opposite like other teams, I think it's more of an indictment of how the pitching staff is still completely in flux, specifically the starters, as much as it is about Rayburn. Because it sounded like what Brian Price had to say today was that Rayburn didn't do anything to not earn himself a spot. He's kind of a victim of the numbers game more than anything else.
Well, for the most part, I mean, his defense at first was not real good, and that could have hurt him as well because that limits him. Not that first place is a place where you're going to get a lot of playing time. You're not going to really pinch hit for the guy that's there, and that guy likes to play a lot. So, you know, if there's playing time at first base, you have bigger issues.
Rayburn is not the solution at that point.
Right.
the solution there is the final solution.
But I guess it's also what they kept emphasizing was the fact that having guys with options and that flexibility that you mentioned too. And,
right.
And Kivelhan has shown, in theory, he can cover the corner of the infield if need be. Plus, he's also got that ability to get shipped out to Louisville if they need to, you know, bring Rookie Davis up or whoever else is that other pitcher they're trying to work into that rotation there as well. And that's obviously a huge issue for them.
No, you're absolutely right there. And that's where Alcantara doesn't have options, but he plays shortstop, which is huge. Yeah. Kivelhan's looked much better at third base than I expected this spring. You know, it hasn't been one of those glaring things. And sometimes you see those. I'm trying to remember who it was at third base last year where you're just like, woo.
It almost seems like he's been the opposite of what Duvall was, because Duvall came up as
a third. That's exactly who I was thinking of, Duvall. Yeah. Duvall was pretty rough out there at third last year. I hear people wanting him to go back there all the time, and people who want him to go back there haven't watched him play there.
Yeah, I thought of Kivelhan as a corner outfielder. I never thought of him as a potential third baseman, and now it seems like he's got ample capability to at least cover there in a pinch.
Yeah, you know, the anti-Duvall or Alex Gordon.
Yeah.
Like Bizarro. Bizarro, Duvall, Gordon.
Well, hopefully it works out. Hopefully that's another, I don't want to say scrap heap, but I guess under the radar, late-blooming prospect pickup for them.
Well, you got a guy who's got really good athleticism and some power. And those are good things to have. You know, Kivelhan is a late bloomer, like you said, but a lot of that's because he didn't play until he was a senior in college because he was a football player. He's a safety at Rutgers. That's the kind of athlete he is. And, you know, it takes a little while. So he's a little bit older, but you miss 3 years of baseball. That's going to mess with some things.
The Amir Garrett path almost. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. You guys reminded me, there's like, you know how you always have, or I don't know if you know this, but like you guys write all the time and you always have these like ideas in the back and like, it's like, oh yeah, I forgot. And I've done half of the stuff for that. I mean, you guys have all been there, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
And I have one like on multi-sport guys because I wanted to talk, I talked to Kivelhan and Amir Garrett early and I was going to get Taylor Trammell because here's a kid in the minor league system who was a great football player. And made the great choice not to go to Georgia Tech because it's always a good choice not to go to Georgia Tech. And it's second year in a row, Tech's lost out by the Reds because Tyler Stevenson was going to play baseball at Tech, but signed with the Reds instead.
That's right. I forgot about Stevenson. That's right. How is Tyler Stevenson, by the way? Just a random off-topic question.
Yeah, I've talked to him. I've seen him briefly, and I've heard good things, but You know, with the minor leagues, I try to get out to the backfields as much as possible, but it's impossible to catch everybody. And it seems like every time I go out, it's the double A, triple A teams and not the 2A teams that are back there.
Right on.
The next place that I want to go is the pitching staff. Now, you know, obviously the Reds still have, they have really two rotation spots locked up and kind of everything else is up in the air as to what they're going to do. I'd say 2.5. Yeah.
With, I mean, if Bronson Arroyo like survives the plane flight back to Cincinnati, I think he's in.
Yeah, I just read Zach's story on that just now, actually, before we went on. So, yeah, it seems like they have a couple of spots locked up. You know, obviously, the fact that Bronson Arroyo is about to make the rotation for this team is a really
telling
jarring thing for, yeah, it's a pretty telltale sign of what's to come here with this pitching staff. Do you have any thoughts as far as who they like in the other two spots, or are you going to be as blindsided as we are when they announce it?
I don't know that I'll be blindsided. I think I'll be prepared for anything. But yeah. I mean, either way, I'm saying I don't know. You know, all five of those or four of those really young guys had given them a good reason to pick them going into this last little bit of the rotation, and then they've all struggled in this last one. I think it was the jobs were still up for them to grab a hold of, and everybody is left question marks on the table. Right. So it'll be really interesting to see what they decide. And I think that should be coming soon.
Right.
You know, I don't see them like, you know, rolling into Louisville on Friday for that exhibition game and being like, okay, we're going back, and then loading up the bus and be like, not you, you stay here.
To me, it's almost the biggest question becomes like, if they are committed to doing that 8-man bullpen, you know, with, I'm doing air quotes over here, are guys like Cody Reed or Robert Stevenson or Tim Adelman, who have always been kind of, you know, pigeonholed into nothing but the starting rotation conversation, do you think they would bring maybe even two of those guys to be long men and or rotational fifth starters? Because
I really do.
They're part of the, you know, their peer group that can't get past 3.5-4 innings.
I really do, and I think that's probably something you might see. And you know, Brian Price has talked a lot about maybe using Stevenson, Reed, or Sal Romano out of the bullpen and kind of getting them starting their career, their big league careers that way. And that's something, I mean, seems like the Cardinals have done that with every big starter they've had come up through the system the last couple of years, and those results have worked. I mean, I don't know if it's the perfect thing, but it certainly says that it is a possibility and it can work. I don't know that if it means it will, but it's a viable option. And, you know, Price has said several times, he goes, I can see those guys. I would actually almost be surprised if one of those guys wasn't in the bullpen. And I'm not even counting Adelman in that. One of those young guys, I would expect to start the season in the bullpen,
right,
and it'll be interesting to see. And I think it's kind of good because, again, we're talking about guys who, I mean, I don't think it's like an eight man commitment to an 8-man bullpen. I think it's like just looking around and being like, whoa, we got to have some bodies who can throw here. And I mean, Hernani Rabarn has thrown some quite a few innings in the minor leagues. So, I mean, that's what you're looking at next.
Yeah. You got 22 games or whatever it is in April and 9 innings a game. You got to get to 195, 198 innings. And based on what we've seen the last couple of weeks, you can't see anybody really going past 4 or 5 at any one given instance. You know, how far do you
have to stretch? Tyler Holt's not here anymore.
Yeah. You know?
No more Skip Schumacher innings.
Yeah.
Right. So we joke, but like you just kind of look at it and it's like, you know, either you have old guys or young guys, and Finnegan is the one that you feel best about. And that's, you know, a year ago we were like, saying, oh, I don't know that he can start a full season. And he actually did. So
yeah. And he's still just, what, 23, about to be 24 years old. And that's the guy that I think we're banking on. So
yeah. Exactly. I think he's one day either older or younger than Cody Reed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Which is, it's amazing that that's kind of, I mean, obviously there's plenty of depth behind that. And we're talking about the fears of the opening day rotation and staff. And obviously that's, the issue because Homer Bailey's bumped back until, June or July. Di Sclafani's bumped back until probably early June, hopefully early June. Yeah. Amir Garrett is, he'll be 25 this year, and they don't want to start his clock immediately, despite the fact that he'd still be, 30, 31 years old by the time he ever reached free agency.
Yeah, I don't think that's as big an issue with Amir that it is maybe some other people. And easily, honestly, when we talk about the clock, it's easier to kind of manipulate that with a pitcher.
Right.
Because you can always do we need to send him down to Louisville for a little bit to get some rest, or
like play around with
the All-Star break. Yeah. And there's always those type of opportunities. What you don't want to do is one of those guys because with Jesse Winker, if he comes up and he takes that opportunity, he plays every day, that's great. But it's also, what is 21 days in the minor leagues hurt if that were to happen? And I'm not saying that's going to happen, because I think they give a little longer leash to both Adam Duvall and Scott Schebler than that. But it's still a possibility.
Yeah. 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 With Garrett, you look up and you say,
we have to look at, remember, injuries are going to make everything moot because people are going to get hurt. It happens.
They already have.
And throughout the season, I mean, remember we were talking about, I think there's this big thing when they signed Bronson Arroyo's, oh, he's going to take innings away from people. It's like, they need innings, to overreact before a season, for a 162 game season. You just have to, you kind of get that tunnel vision sometimes, and you need to step back and go, oh yeah, there's 162 games, and really 162 games that are more about development than winning.
Yeah. I mean, we look up last year and what Tim Melville and AJ Morris and Josh Smith and
AJ Morris. I'd forgotten about AJ Morris.
There's somebody else. There was a fourth go-to in that group of, you'll never remember these 5 years from now.
Yeah. It's with the Angels now.
Steve Delabar, J.C. Ramirez.
Yeah.
J.C. Ramirez has been great for the Angels this year. Yeah. The other guy for the Angels I'm thinking of.
Chris O'Grady.
Chris O'Grady was a Rule 5 guy.
Right.
He started several games and came up from Pensacola.
Daniel Wright.
Yeah.
Daniel Wright. Yeah.
10th rounder. That's right. Yeah. And I mean,
talking about.
Yeah, and when guys like Johnny Cueto and Mike Leake got traded for pitching prospects, at the time we look up and say, why are they trading for so many pitching prospects? What the heck? John Lamb, now with the Angels also, too, I think. So, you look up and suddenly the injury bug and how all these things tend to typically play out inevitably does play out. We looked up before Brandon Phillips finally agreed to get traded, which is a whole side topic in all of this. We wondered how the middle infield for the Reds was going to shake out with Phillips and Cozart and Peraza and Dilson Herrera. And then a week into camp, you find out Dilson Herrera can't throw. Brandon Phillips is gone. And suddenly Zach Cozart is going to have to play absolutely every day at shortstop. So, yeah, these things always tend to have a way of working themselves out, whether you want them to or not.
Right. I was talking to Wayne Krivsky the other day. And, I was like, hey, Wayne, remember when everybody said you're crazy for signing a fourth, for trading for a fourth second baseman?
Right. Yeah. Nope. Yeah. How'd that work out for him? Yeah.
That worked out pretty well. He was, and I was like, I said, you had a pretty good, 2 weeks that year. That was 05, or was it 06?
06. Yeah.
And, within 2 weeks near the end of spring training, he did the Brandon Phillips trade and the Bronson Arroyo trade. And he's like, oh, yeah, and I signed David Ross, too.
Oh, yeah.
I had forgotten about Ross.
Was it Tony Womack?
Tony Womack was the opening day starter at second base.
That's right. Good Lord. What a 10 years it's been.
Oh, man. I actually, for a story, it's funny you mentioned that. For a story last night, for a special section, I was going through the 2007 Baseball America Prospect Handbook and doing the top 30 team, the top 30 prospects from 2007. And, I mean, you do this for every – this isn't just the Reds. This is everybody. There's some names on there that you just totally had forgotten. Justin Reed, you know, BJ Zemanski, Rafael Gonzalez. I'm like, you know, number 30 prospect, some guy named Josh Hamilton.
What's funny? What's funny when you list off all these names for us, because we've made a habit over the years. And BK, you know this better than anybody else because you spent so much time doing it. For the farmers only that we go through and we write, it's become kind of a habit slash a joke of establishing nicknames as early as possible for these guys, so that you actually get some sort of name recognition while they're playing in Billings or Chattanooga when it was back then and all that jazz. So you bring up these names and instantly I'm trying to run back through all the nicknames that got put in for all those guys. That's funny.
How about this? I was going through, I'm writing this story. Joey Votto in 2006, the Baseball America, he was number 9 in the Red system between Tyler Pellin and Travis Chick.
Wow.
You know, in 2004, he was number 5 between Dustin Mosley and Phil Dumatre.
Oh, Phil Dumatre. Yeah. The slurvy lefty. Yeah.
But that's a blasphemy. But the 07, you know, when you have Homer Bailey 1, Jay Bruce 2, Johnny Joey Votto 3, and Johnny Cueto 4.
Yeah.
I mean, that shows why they won. You know, they were in the playoffs 3 out of 4 years.
Yeah.
Three or 4 years later.
It's like you mentioned that, and that literally was that era right there, that 2007, 2006, 2008 era was why I actually found Red Reporter. Because for the first time in forever, I was extremely excited about the future of the Reds and started, I think it was Yahooing back there. I hadn't quite got around to Googling at that point. And stumbled upon this random Cincinnati Reds site that was talking about the future of the system and how good it was and how bright it was. It's crazy to have.
And they're like, right.
Joel Lookup, imagine that. I actually knew what the heck he was talking about back then. So, but it's funny now.
You know, when you look at these lists, it's about creating big leaguers. And it's not always, you know, your top guys. But, like, they had the four we mentioned, Drew Stubbs, Travis Wood, Paul Janisch, Chris Valleca, Sam LaCure, Chris Dickerson, John Koutlangas, Jordan Smith, Brad Salmon, Juan Francisco, Norris Hopper, Josh Hamilton. That doesn't include, I think, is still in the system then, but not anywhere in this list. This guy, Justin Turner.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Who got Ramon Hernandez, right?
Yeah. Ramon Hernandez.
Yeah.
It, but from the Orioles.
Yeah.
And then he went from the Orioles to the Mets to the Dodgers. I mean, this is... These things aren't a straight line, and it's amazing to look at how they do it.
Yeah, they did better than they probably got credit for with some of these guys. Drafting at least.
The Rays were the number one team in the talent rankings that year. The Reds were number 12. So let's see, what does Tampa have? Their number one guy, Delman Young.
Right.
But Evan Longoria, that was pretty good. Reed Brignac, Wade Davis, Jeremy Hellickson. After that, there's not Wade Townsend. Desmond Jennings is now with the Reds. Because of Votto and Hamilton, you probably – I haven't done this, and I just don't have the time to do it. I would like to do it if I was better at computers. I'd like to look at the war of all those teams, all 30 teams, and I think the Reds might have a pretty good chance because there's no Mike Trout, and B, you know, Hamilton and Votto.
Yeah,
it's but also some of those and Cueto.
Yeah, that's what I was going to mention. Is it's impressive because it's not just anchored by one or two specific guys in terms of position prospects. It's, you know, phenomenal pitching, phenomenal around the diamond position prospect guys too. It's a literally a diamond wide, excellent example of how well they scouted through that entire period.
Yeah. Well, and I think too, like part of that is the Reds list. When you look at some of the role players, just like, right, not even if some guys weren't, you know, high profile major leaguers, like everyday guys, you know, you look at a Sam LaCure who, you know, was college pitcher, really was looking like a quadruple A guy. And he had a couple of really productive bullpen years and really was a key part of some of those Reds teams. So
you
need guys like that to pan out too, even if, you know, not all of the big guys do.
100%. And I think that's a great point and something to always remember is, I mean, you need role guys too. And a lot of times those role guys don't, they're not going to give you that big war number, just the way the war is based. But they're going to be valuable, and they're going to create some value. And I think it's important to remember. And they've got to come from somewhere.
Right. Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that, just because looking up and kind of like, you know, connecting back to the Ryan Rayburn talk we had earlier. In cutting Rayburn, that basically leaves Jennings as the veteran on the bench at age, what, 30? And the other guys that they're projecting to kind of make the team, if Alcantara does, if it's Kivlahan, if it's Tony Rinda, aside from Hernan Iribar and all the rest of the guys that look like they're going to be bench bats, even Stuart Turner, if it's him, they're mid-20s guys. They're not the Jack Hanahans and the Skip Schumachers of the recent Reds teams. I wonder if that's kind of happenstance because they had the opportunity to claim these guys because they were so high on the waiver order, or if it's kind of a concept that they looked up and said, hey, we need to get younger, we need to get more versatile and more athletic, because that's certainly how it looks like the roster is going to take shape.
I think they really looked at versatility. And, you know, Alcantara's a guy I've always kind of liked. He's got a pretty good skill set. He struggled at first at shortstop, but really since that first week at short, he's been fine. And that's if you can play short and center and run a little bit, that's a valuable bench player.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we look up at what, like guys like I'm trying to think in recent memory who have been able to do something like that. Like Chris Negron had a fantastic year off the bench doing that and got, you know, upwards of 150, 200 plate appearances, which I think Alcantara will get more of this year. Jose Peraza kind of filled that role last year by default. But yeah, I think if you can do that in quantity and be versatile enough to be patient to wait and maybe not play for 3 or 4 days, but then play when somebody gets hurt for 2 straight weeks, I think Alcantara fits that mold perfectly almost.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Wow. So, I'm sorry, I go through one of my favorite things in the world to do is to go through old drafts. And this just shows you, no, like baseball drafts. That does sound like, wow, fun time at the Rosecrans household. let's party and look at this 2002 draft. But I was talking to a buddy of mine, Pedro Mora, who covers the A's for the, or the Angels for the Los Angeles Times. And he was doing something on the Mike Trout draft in 2009 and just talking about how all these teams had a chance to have Mike Trout. And honestly, you look at the Reds and they have one of the more understandable picks. So they're like, oh, we're about to contend. We need a pitcher close to the big leagues. And they took Mike Leake. And, you know, I bet Mike Leake is probably higher in the list of career war from those first round picks than his slot in the draft. He was like, oh, at 9? Mm-hmm. I think he's like 6th in career war. Everybody.
And 6 years later.
Everybody trails.
Yeah, so 6 years later was worthy of a $90 million contract, too. So it's not like he, you know, it was a flash in the pan. It's obviously he's been well received throughout that process. But yeah,
I also, and the Reds got Duvall.
Yeah, they did. I'll for that. Yeah. I do look back and I wonder if the Corey Seager draft is going to end up being like, obviously not quite Mike Trout level, but some of the names that were in that particular year, I wonder if that's going to be the one that we look back, you know, 4 or 5 years down the road and say, oh, man, where was that?
Yeah, and the story I'm going to do later this year, I'm probably tipping my cap, and hopefully nobody, you guys don't do this big story now and make me not be able to do it. But because I'm writing about Joey Votto and his development for our special section, but the Joey Votto draft, So right. Think about 2002. What do we know about 2002 draft? Do you guys know off the top of your head?
2002. That wasn't Matt Bush. Matt Bush was 2004. 2002 would have been what?
That's the Moneyball draft.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
And I mean, you think about the Moneyball in that era, Billy Beane, who would be the most Moneyball player ever for Billy Beane that year?
Oh, from the movie, the Scott, you can play first base, no big deal. Like, Votto was a catcher from Canada. Like,
exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Do you know how many picks Votto was taken with the third pick overall in the second round?
Second round.
Like 42nd.
Yeah, in the second round.
Yeah.
Yeah, 44th, I think. Do you know how many picks the A's had before the 44th pick?
Oh, no.
Seven. I'm not kidding. They took Nick Swisher. That's defensible. I mean, yeah. that's a good
That's a great
Joe pick. Blanton, again. John McCurdy with 26th overall. Ben Fritz at 30. The infamous Jeremy Brown at 35.
Right.
Steve Openchain at 37. And Mark Tehan at 39.
Yeah, it became
so kind of, Billy Beane.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, because they were going after the college bats, and that was the big thing. It's like, oh, we don't need, you know, high schools are too risky, right. Because you don't know the competition. And then I'm guessing for them, Canadian high schools are even more poison, but they had seven picks to get Joey Votto,
and didn't.
Yeah, but the fact that they actually even took a catcher in Jeremy Brown, who obviously Moneyball was, he was very much featured in that. But you know, yeah, they passed on a catcher named Joey Votto at that. That's crazy.
Yeah, seven picks. Yeah. It blew my mind.
Yeah.
I didn't even think of it that way until I actually went to a book signing. Do you guys know who Tabitha Soren is? Anybody old enough for that?
Yeah, I remember Tabitha Soren. Absolutely.
Well, she's Michael Lewis's wife.
Oh, really?
And Yeah, she did a book, a photography book of the Moneyball class and the A's drafts picks of that year and followed them throughout their careers. And she had a lecture talk or something at the Phoenix Art Museum. And Mark Sheldon and I went to that earlier this year. And then it dawned on me that it all comes back to this. And so that was kind of interesting.
Yeah.
That's wild. And we got a Tabitha Soren reference on the podcast. We got like Kurt Loder and Downtown Judy Brown and everybody else. Yes. Like that's fantastic. Wow.
Yeah, Zach had no idea who Tabitha Soren was. And I was like, and I even go MTV News and he like looks at me blank and I'm like, oh, hell, I'm man. So old.
Oh man. That's rough. That's kids. Rough. Oh Lord. So well, I guess as we're looking back through like, you know, the way the Reds used to be and how all these drafts panned out, we've mentioned a little bit how in 2007, 2008, the Reds had these great prospects that were not just well-regarded, but actually panned out. But the team's mm-hmm. win-loss record at the time really wasn't very good. The hope is in all of this is that what we're going through right now is kind of similar to what was happening back then, where they're accumulating a lot of great prospects, some through trade, a lot through draft. Do you see any similarities between those two? And how different is it being in a clubhouse watching that than it was kind of in like 2012, 2013 when they're winning 90 games left and right?
Yeah, it's different. And a lot of that is just the different personalities.
Yeah, I know that's a really odd question. Sorry about that. But
it is. No, that's fine. And I'm giving you a really broad, terrible answer. I've been around like daily. I've only been around Reds clubhouses, but like I know other guys who talk about like, you know, you have some clubhouses that seem that they're all together and it's this great atmosphere and they're winning, but you also have some where they're winning and nobody's talking and nobody's doing anything. Yeah. So much of that I think can be overstated because this is one of my least favorite words, but I get it. It's an easy narrative sometimes. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It's like, oh yeah, you know, most times when people are winning at the professional level, they're happier than when they're losing. And so I think that can get overblown, but I think there's also something to be said for people coming to work and being excited to come to work, and also having people who, having examples to do things the right way. Joey Votto isn't a guy who is going to go put his arm around someone and go, "Hey, Rook, come with me."
Yeah.
But honestly, like last year, the biggest thing I thought of, my biggest takeaway of last year was early in the season, you know, I'd notice that Billy Hamilton would go out early, and what he was doing was watching Joey Votto. And at some point, he's watching Joey Votto take BP, early BP, do early work, and they start talking. Before too long, you'll hear Hamilton every day, "Jovo, what time we hitting?" And that was his thing. He was going to go out and do that early work with Joey Votto every day. And he talked about how it just, you know, he just tried to learn from him and talk to him and think about things, you know. And when you look at the second half of Billy Hamilton's season, was that it? I don't know if this was causation or correlation or just coincidence, but he really improved his on base. He walked more. He did some more things. Now, that's a short sample size of a half a season, and really not even a half a season because he missed the last month. But it is an interesting story, and if it does stick a little bit, you say, yeah, there was a lot of crap, and it was a pretty bad year in 2016. But if Billy Hamilton turns out to be the Billy Hamilton that can get on base at, what, 330? And that's not that high of a bar. That's a little bit higher than average. But if he's a 330 on base guy, and for the next 3 years, that's where he is.
That's a 5-1.
You would say that's a right, awesome. Exactly.
Yeah.
You know, you would say, well, 2016, that's one of the big things you can take out of it. And you can say that, hey, you know, we saw what Brandon Finnegan could do. You know, and so I think, you know, people are asking me, like, I want to know what's a success this year. And I was like, it's tough to say that. Because you're going to be surprised, and there's going to be hindsight. You know, 2007-08, I remember that's when Homer Bailey got his feet wet. Jay Bruce got his feet wet. Joey Votto got his feet wet. Johnny Cueto got his feet wet. Those things weren't always pretty, but it led to 2010, 12, and 13.
Yeah. Since you brought up Hamilton, Trent, do you buy into the elevated walk rate toward the end of the season, more ground balls? Do you think there's been a little bit of a shift, or is it just too little info to tell yet?
I think it's too hard to tell yet. You know, that's such a, you know, like I said, I mean, it's a small sample. I think there's an ability there, but you just don't know yet. I think there's hope because, again, it correlates with that nice narrative. And if that really does work, I mean, that's, I don't know. I mean, that's my bottom line is Billy Hamilton is a defensive player is going to be worth being in your lineup. If he's somewhere around, you know, plus or minus 10 points of league average on base percentage, he's worthy of the top of your lineup. But if he's not, he's still a pretty worthy defender. I mean, we saw it in the last month when Billy Hamilton wasn't out there. The pitching staff wasn't as good. And I think there was really a belief. I mean, I really think that's a big part of it. He's such a dynamic outfielder. And he's, quite honestly, Billy Hamilton is, if he could pick the best situation for himself, at worst, Great American Ballpark is the worst possible place that Billy Hamilton can play.
Yeah.
Because it's a small outfield, which decreases his defensive value, and it also decreases his potential for hits because there's less surface area and it's easier to catch the ball in the air from where he is. I mean, if he played in Colorado, I harp on this all the time, I think he's an all-star. you know, those, that big, big expansive outfield, the, some of those things can fall in for hits. I mean, he's got doubles for days on just what are general base hits.
Not to mention his defensive run save. Like I remember looking up recently at a Kevin Kiermaier article talking about how vastly beyond Billy Hamilton's numbers defensively Kiermaier's had over the last 3 years. I'm looking up and saying, actually, I took it back. It was when I was looking at Desmond Jennings. That's when I stumbled across Kiermaier and looking up at the park factors in Tampa and seeing how much bigger that ballpark plays. You give Billy Hamilton 3 to 4 extra full strides on defense to track balls down when he's not running into the walls, he's going to get them. Like, he's going to get all of them. And that's what Kiermaier has done. And he just landed a $50 million contract as a result. But yeah, it's crazy to think actually that speaking of old Reds days, I do remember having this discussion with somebody in the Chris Heisey, Drew Stubbs center field debate and saying that Drew Stubbs was kind of miscast in the home ballpark of Great American because his greatest strength, they didn't get a chance to get value out of it. Whereas Heisey wasn't as good of a defensive center fielder, but I thought his offense might have been able to recoup some of that value while playing in Great American. This is completely off topic.
That's why they played Chu at center.
Yeah.
That's why they played Chu in center, because they could.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember having this discussion with Jay Bruce. I was talking to Jay about, you know, DRS and all these, the defensive fielding numbers. He goes, you know, when I had my best year statistically on those numbers are when Chu was in center, because I got those balls. Yeah. And when Billy's there, my range factor is not great because it doesn't have to be.
why should it be? Yeah. There's no reason for it. Yeah.
You know, his range factor is going to be much lower because Billy's is wider.
Yeah.
And I remember, and so, I mean, park factors fall into that so much. I mean, Kiermaier, I think, is amazing. But I would love to see – you guys might know this better than I haven't looked at, like, park neutralized of those numbers, and I just don't know that you can actually physically do that. I'm sure somebody – some smart person really has. But it is certainly a factor.
Statcast probably is in the process of kind of delineating that at this point, which is, watching what they've done has been awesome. Awesome to pull off.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah.
If we've run out of things to talk about, Trent, will Jose Peraza draw a walk this spring?
If the over under is one, I'm going to take the over.
He's running out of time.
But no, I mean, it's interesting. He hasn't taken one in spring, but I mean, Peraza is such that throwback kind of, I mean, he's that throwback guy. And, you know, there's the old saying, you don't walk off the island, even though Venezuela isn't an island. But like, you know, like Ichiro isn't a guy who walked. These guys that have good contact skills and good speed, you know, every player is different. And I was looking back and, you know, you don't want a Joey Votto to swing at everything, and you don't want, Jose Peraza to not. I mean, I think there are different things and sure, ideally he would take more, but one of his biggest skill is putting the bat on the baseball. And, when you couple that with above average speed, that's a good thing. It would be better if he walked a little bit more, but we'll see. And again, I mean, these are terribly small sample sizes.
Yeah.
And that's something to always remember. I mean, Joey Votto was hitting 191 last I looked, and I will take the over on that as well.
Yeah. I feel like with Peraza, it'd be one thing if he was striking out 20-25% of the time, but he's not.
Right.
And I do remember there was one, it might have been a Brewers broadcast. It was one of the opposing MLB TV feeds I was watching earlier this year on one of the games, and they were talking about the fact that he hadn't walked yet, and he was in the process of fouling off like 7 pitches in a row. And so he got to like a 10 or 11 pitch at bat before I think he popped out. But still, like, it's not like he's striking out and not taking any pitches and swinging at the first pitch and putting it in play. He's trying to barrel the bat, and he does a lot. And so I'm less concerned about the walk, you know, with him. It's not as much of an issue because he does the other aspect very, very well.
You know, he's looked better at short the little time he's played short than I've had scouts who say that he's he's been better at short than they expected and that they remembered.
Interesting.
And so that's something to think about. Cause you know, I don't think Zach Cozart's going to be here at the end of the year. And, for shortstops, you have Peraza, Vincy, and then a lower down is Alfredo Rodriguez. Alfredo Rodriguez is going to be here this year. Zach Vincy may be, but once Cozart is gone, Peraza is probably going to be at shortstop.
Yeah. It's almost like he was worth trading Aroldis Chapman and or Todd Frazier for him, if you think about it.
Well, yeah. He's no Gleyber Torres.
That's true.
I mean, that trade is going to be the one that haunts them forever. And there's so many things on that. They couldn't have picked a worse time to trade him.
Yeah.
And they did pick the worst time to trade him. And that's tough. And I know, yeah, it'll be one that lives forever, especially considering what the Yankees got in return for even less time. But you know, I still remember I talked to somebody with the Astros, and the Reds in 2015. The Reds were talking to the Astros, and you know, the guy I talked to said the Reds were asking for the moon plus for Chapman.
Yeah, as they should have.
And, but I talked to somebody with the Astros, and said, "Hey, knowing what you know now, and remember, think about the 2015 Astros." You know, if they have Aroldis Chapman, they beat the Royals.
Yeah.
And they probably go to the World Series. And so this is afterwards. I said, knowing what you know now, would you give up what the Reds were asking for Chapman? And a guy goes, no. And that's for a year and a half of Chapman.
Yeah.
That's how much apparently they were asking. And then 3 months later, taking, you know, a deal that I'm guessing, you know, Brian Cashman couldn't get that paperwork in fast enough.
Yeah.
Although I'll say, you know, Rookie Davis has been the guy this spring. He's looked like the guy that was with the Yankees and not the guy who was with the Reds last year. And Rookie said he was hurt last year in his legs. And with his legs back, he's been consistently 95, you know, he's been pitching that 93 to 96 range. And I've gotten a lot of good reports on him.
Yeah, that's a solid, you know, that's not a minor increase. That's 4 to 5 miles an hour on average over what he was getting.
Right.
Last year. Yeah.
I mean, and that's not Gleyber Torres. I'm not, you know, in no way, shape and form am I saying that was a good deal.
Yeah.
But, you know, at this point you move on and say, well, this is the guy we got. Let's see what he does.
Well, although now you've got me thinking about what George Springer would look like in the outfield for the Reds right now, and that's haunting me. So,
yeah, I mean, really,
man,
or Alex Bregman,
man, I can't even imagine.
Yeah,
but I guess with that we're gonna wrap up. I think we're right about at our time. So,
cool.
So, make sure to look in the Enquirer for Trent stuff. Follow him on Twitter at @ctrent. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at @RedReporter.
And if you're searching for another thing to listen to after this, the Reds Beat podcast that we put out every Wednesday.
Yes.
Me and Zach. And then this week, I think we're supposed to record with Dick Williams tomorrow.
Right on.
Nice. That should be out Wednesday. So if you want to listen to that, we're kind of feeling our way through these things. And, you know, this spring we did a lot of different guests and, different writers where we talk about other teams, but I kind of like that because so often I think there's tunnel vision on one team and it's kind of nice to look around. So we talked to we had Rustin Dodd of the Kansas City Star, because, you know, I think there's some interesting parallels between that Royals run and the Reds.
Yeah.
We had Andy McCullough of the Los Angeles Times, Pedro Mora of the Los Angeles Times. So we had lots of Mike Trout talk last week. And I mean, you can't get enough Mike Trout talk.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's amazing. just like, you know, Pedro apparently, you know, he's not the Angels beat writer, he's the Mike Trout beat writer.
Yeah.
And so there's some interesting stuff. I mean, because it's this guy's like, it's amazing that I think Mike Trout is underrated.
He's massively underrated. Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah, but his team is obviously a part of it. But you think back to,
he's considered the best player in baseball and he's underrated.
Yeah.
That's how good he is.
You think back to how good A-Rod was when he was peak A-Rod and playing for a terrible team in Texas. At least people still knew every bit about who he was. He was still front page news. Trout's been that good, if not better, and you hear nothing about him hardly at all. Yeah, it's fascinating.
I heard a stat the other day, or today. I was listening, I think it was on the Ringer podcast, their MLB show, that Mike Trout's never finished lower than second in MVP voting in his career.
It got robbed at least twice, probably. Yeah.
And he was, again, underrated.
And was 23, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's absurd. It's absurd. Well, I
hope. So at the very least, we live in a world with Mike Trout, and so it can't be all that bad.
It can't be that bad. And you get to follow Joey Votto on a daily basis. We do, too.
And watch Billy Hamilton.
And watch Billy Hamilton. Yeah. And while it might not be Mike Trout, it's still damn entertaining one way or another, so.
Well, that's what I would always say. Like, you know, 2 years ago, I was like, I watch Joey Votto hit every day, Billy Hamilton run the outfield every day, and I got a chance to see Aroldis Chapman.
Yeah.
I mean,
right. Yeah. Yeah.
It, to me, and maybe this is someone who grew up a Kansas City Royals fan, you know, a lot of times it's just, and actually, no, I think this is not really my Royals, growing up a Royals fan, as much as it was growing up a Royals fan who wasn't in the Kansas City area, so that I never lived anywhere with a big league ball team.
Yeah.
And so to me, every time I could go to a baseball game, whether it was the minors or the majors, for me, it was an event and it was something special. And even if it was two teams out of contention, I was lucky when I lived in Texas, the Astros were pretty good. That late 80s, early 90s. And so that wasn't always the case. But, you know, going to a baseball game was awesome. And it the result didn't matter. And we went to a lot of games that weren't the Royals. I mean, this was you would go to the Astros games and without a rooting interest. But it was like, you know what? Watching Major League Baseball at the highest level is pretty cool. It's pretty cool.
I think you just described every Colorado Rockies game I've been to for the last 6 years. That's pretty much spot on. So, yeah.
It's a great place to watch a game.
It's a fantastic spot to watch a game. I can totally empathize.
How about this? I think that's the third oldest ballpark in the National League.
It is, yeah, behind Dodger Stadium and Wrigley. Really? Yeah. Yep, it is.
I tweeted that out like next, like, because even, and that's not even counting, it was the third oldest last year.
Uh-huh. And it wasn't,
now you have Turner Field dead.
And it wasn't even the first stadium the Rockies played in. The Rockies played a Mile High for 2 years, right. I think, before they moved into Coors. So, yeah.
And they're purple.
They are obnoxiously purple.
But that's the thing is like, there's no chance a team was going to be purple until the 90s. And that is such a thing that this team's played in two stadiums, and this is the third oldest stadium in the National League, and they're purple.
Well, at least they didn't end up with teal. At least the Marlins got teal.
Yeah. You know, it's like, and then the Diamondbacks tried both.
Devil Rays did both too, kind of.
Yeah, kind of.
Devil Rays did everything.
The old Wade Boggs jersey. Oh, man. Yeah. Lord.
The Fred McGriff hat. It's unbelievable. You know, it's like you might as well just be like, I don't know, have the rolled up pegged jeans on your Rockies uniform. Denim, fake denim, pegged jeans like the '94 U.S. soccer team.
Slap race the whisper ends.
Those are the best. Yeah,
that's great.
Man, I'm sorry I took this off the rails when you guys were trying to get rid of me. So
No. Well, that just solidifies that we need to have you back as soon as possible because we could probably do another hour.
That is quintessential Red Reporter podcast right there. Trust us.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right where we're at.
So let me talk about the black drop shadow on the Reds here. We'll save that for the next time because I hate it.
Yes.
How great do those spring training jerseys look? Oh my god! On the lettering nice, on the back. They look so much better. It's not that hard.
How about last year when they wore the 90 uniforms and they had those just gorgeous hats that are just red with the white C?
Yeah. Imagine that.
The black, you're the Cincinnati Reds.
Yeah. That's a Hiroshima Carp hat now.
It is.
Oh,
it is.
Man.
It yes. is. Oh.
All right. I'm sorry, guys. I apologize. No,
So, all right. So until the next time that Trent comes back on, we will see you next time.
Bye, guys.